This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Agriculture is the number one industry in North Carolina, contributing $78 billion to the state's economy. Much of the food produced in our state comes from the eastern part of the state, which was recently pounded with heavy rainfall during Hurricane Matthew, leaving fields flooded and crops ravaged. I spoke with director for the State Farm Agency, Bob Etheridge, who estimates hundreds of millions of dollars in damages here in eastern North Carolina. Mr. Etheridge was in Edgecombe County on Thursday to see the damage firsthand.
Well, we had with us the Deputy Secretary of USDA, President and Secretary Vilsack, asked him to come down, and we saw some of the worst land erosion. We saw one 25-acre field that was just totally devastated. I have never seen anything that bad. We visited a couple of fields. We went to one peanut field that was underwater, and of course the peanuts had been turned up there, lost. Part of them had been washed out of the field in the woods. And the last field we went to was about a 200-acre field of sweet potatoes, and right beside it was another probably 200-acre field of soybeans. Both fields had been under, I believe the farmer told us, about 8 feet of water for several days. And needless to say, both were a total loss. According to the farmer himself, it's about $1,800 per acre he had invested in those 200 acres, and you can figure right quick that you're looking at over $750,000 of direct loss in that one field.
What are some of the hardest hit crops for North Carolina?
Well, I think the hardest hit crop across the state, sweet potatoes, peanuts, and soybeans. In some places, depending on the county, some corn. Now, most of the corn had been harvested, but some got hit. A lot of vegetable crops in places like Sampson and Bladen and others that had a lot of winter vegetables were obviously damaged, and in some places, totally destroyed.
Well, what do you expect is the economic impact due to agricultural damage?
Oh, we don't know yet. Because until we, you know, gather together, because it isn't just the row crops, it's poultry. There's some pork, turkeys, chickens. I would have to believe it'll be in the hundreds of millions of dollars in eastern North Carolina. That's a lot of money taken out of local economies that'll here. And this is the second year in a row we've had losses in eastern North Carolina as a result of too much water, too much bad weather.
I was going to mention that. I actually spoke with you a year ago, almost to the day, when eastern North Carolina, of course, received that heavy rainfall in October, 20 inches in some places.
Sure.
How would you compare this year to last?
Well, overall, I think this year is worse. But the problem is, if you're that farmer and farm family and community that you had problems last year, you're rolling into this year. Look, in June, we had one of the best crops going we probably had in many years, and then all of a sudden you get to September and October and it's gone. These farmers still have to pay their bills. They have to have money to pay for, you know, food and clothing for themselves and house payments and power bills. All of a sudden, they've had a second year in a row loss. And for many of them, it is going to be a long slog through this winter. And many of them right now probably don't know how bad it's going to be and won't know for another week or so, maybe a few weeks.
Would you call this an agricultural crisis in North Carolina?
Well, for the farmer who's lost it, it will be. I wouldn't say it will be overall, but I would say for individual farmers, it is a crisis. And when individuals have it, then overall, we need to do everything in our power, and we're going to use every tool we've got at USDA. And then we're going to be asking for additional help, because it's going to be up to the policymakers in Congress to come up with some additional resources to help.
So what is the first step that farmers should take to apply for assistance from the USDA?
The first thing every farmer should do, even if they don't have any insurance, is go by their farm service agency in their counties. Because we're now asking them to do that, even if they don't have coverage, fill out what they think their losses are. So we will have those numbers to share with state government and with federal government so we can tally up what the overall loss is. Because if people don't know, they can't help you.
Mr. Etheridge, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you much. Look forward to talking to you again, but I hope not on these circumstances.
As eastern North Carolina continues its recovery from Hurricane Matthew, polls are open for early voting. North Carolina is among the most coveted states in the presidential race and has one of the tightest senatorial and gubernatorial races in the nation. but is voting a high priority for areas hit hardest by major flooding less than a month ago? Chris Thomas spoke to voters this week and has this.
As of Wednesday, more than 2.2 million North Carolinians turned out to vote ahead of Election Day. That's up 15% from the same time 4 years ago, according to Patrick Gannon of the State Board of Elections. In hard-hit Pitt County, where hundreds of residents and business owners are still recovering from flooding, the early voting rate is up by 7.5%, a trend that's being realized across much of the state.
When you combine that with all of the other absentee, the mail-in absentee ballots, we're well over 2.3 million, and overall turnout is already at 34.1%.
Gannon said he wasn't sure what to expect this year, due in part to the storm's impact. Five eastern counties, Columbus, Cumberland, Lenoir, Pitt, and Robeson, had to move voting precincts for Election Day because of floodwater damages. But that hasn't stopped thousands of early voters across the east.
Dare and Currituck counties are up 57% and 66% respectively. But then there are a few counties, Robeson being one of them, that are down slightly.
Gannon went on to say he expects those numbers to improve since more polling stations open during the final week of early voting. One of the counties to benefit from that is Craven County, which has seen early voter turnout improve by 9% in comparison to 2012. That's no surprise to Melanie Ray, Craven County's Board of Elections Director.
I've been in this county, like I said, 3 years, and there have been increases from previous years. And I think with it being a new presidential candidate coming in because the terms are up, I think it brings more interest when you have a complete turnover.
The Board of Elections office on Broad Street wasn't directly impacted by the flooding, but some of its employees were.
Well, actually, I have some workers that live in Vanceboro that came in and tried to get here to work as well during that time of the flood. And obviously roads were blocked and they had to have different routes to get here.
One of those workers is Ella Mitchell of Vanceboro. Her home made it through the storm without extensive damage, but some of her relatives live at the heart of Craven County's flood zone and had to evacuate.
I did have a family who was affected to come and spend about 2 weeks with me. They lived on Swift Creek and they had to be out for a while.
Despite record-setting flooding from the Neuse River, Mitchell said hotly contested races up and down the ballot haven't been forgotten in Craven County.
A lot of people have really been concerned about school board, and they want to make sure that they're able to vote for their school board candidate of their choice in their district.
Dealing with a flood can leave a person feeling powerless. Voting, Mitchell said, can be part of the recovery process.
It gives you a little bit of an empowerment. So, you know, your one vote is something that you can control. And when you're in a situation where you have been flooded or had any kind of major loss, it's a kind of helpless and you don't feel like you have any control over that. So getting out to vote is one thing and one process that does give you normalcy, and it does let you know that I have control over this part.
Downtown Greenville, threatened by rising waters just a few weeks ago from the Tar River, is bustling with activity as residents head to the polls to cast their ballots. Martin Tansky owns and operates Peddling Pirates, a bicycle rickshaw business.
We've been contracted out to carry people to the early voting polling place from campus this afternoon.
How busy have you been today?
This is my first time over here, actually. I just started at 2, so I think people are starting to come out on campus, and they're signing people up at the booth, and I'm going to be taking people over here throughout the day.
Tansky takes students from ECU's main campus to the Willis Building about 5 blocks north. It's also owned by the university, and it overlooks the town common.
The guy that set up the charter, he was saying that there's a lot of people that express interest in voting, and he thinks it's going to be a pretty big turnout this afternoon.
Tansky said he hasn't voted yet. He plans on it, but he's been preoccupied. He lives just east of the town common, on the other side of the Town Creek Bridge, a neighborhood that experienced heavy flooding after Hurricane Matthew.
Well, I actually got back from a little vacation in Florida, and when I got back, the city was under a state of emergency, and they evacuated my neighborhood. There was water about 8 feet away from coming into my house.
Some weren't so lucky. Abby Lewis, a Fayetteville native and East Carolina sophomore, saw that starkly when she went back home.
We helped people like get everything out of their homes. One of my best friend's houses actually was completely underwater. They had a picture of it where literally the beacon of their house was only 6 inches out of the water. And so they lost everything. And I had so many friends that lost, like, everything they owned.
But she cast her vote this week anyway, part of a steady stream of balloters passing by colorful signs and last-minute campaigners.
I mean, everyone needs to take part in it. And when people say that their vote doesn't matter, you know, you have to think that it's not one big country where everyone's just casting one vote. It goes from county to county, from county to state, from state to nation.
Early voting continues through Saturday, and Election Day is Tuesday, November 8th. I'm Chris Thomas.
As the baby boomer generation ages and people live longer, a new trend has emerged from the growing population of older adults. It affects approximately 1 in 10 seniors, according to the National Council on Aging, but that number could be higher since many cases go unreported. Emergency physician Dr. Tim Platts-Mills.
The number of older adults in our society is increasing, and in fact is sort of going to double almost over between about 2010 and 2045 or 50. It's going to double. So the total magnitude of the problem is definitely increasing. Whether or not the percentage of patients affected is increasing or not is less clear.
Dr. Platts-Mills is an assistant professor and the director of clinical research in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Elder abuse is defined as intentional acts by a caregiver that cause harm or a risk of harm to a vulnerable older adult. With more than 23 million visits annually by seniors, emergency departments are increasingly becoming an important setting for identifying victims of elder abuse.
We tend to take care of patients with a little bit more cognitive impairment and a little bit more medical problems, both of which are risk factors for elder abuse.
Even though the majority of seniors who go to emergency departments are not harmed by their caretakers, they will most likely be screened. This involves being asked a single question: do you feel safe at home?
Our research in our emergency department suggests that it really doesn't capture much. It doesn't seem to identify a lot of cases.
Dr. Platts-Mills believes the safety question isn't effective when trying to diagnose the most common form of elder abuse, neglect. He adds, cognitively impaired patients who are the most susceptible to elder abuse may also slip through the cracks.
It might be harder for them to say, hey, I'm having a problem with abuse. They might not recognize it as a problem. They may just feel like, oh, that's the situation I'm in. And they might be scared about the solution because they might be scared about being, you know, sent to a nursing home and that sort of thing.
Dr. Platts-Mills was part of a study published in mid-October in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society that used a nationally representative data set to estimate the frequency with which emergency providers made a formal diagnosis of elder abuse.
We thought, well, maybe we would see a rate around 7 to 10%, and what we saw instead was that we saw less than 0.1%. So it was 1 out of 7,000 cases had a formal diagnosis of elder abuse, which means that there are lots and lots of the patients who are coming through the door of the emergency department with an ongoing problem of elder abuse are not being diagnosed.
Pinpointing elder abuse, he admits, is very difficult.
If you're an older adult and you have a bruise, well, the list of the number of reasons why you might have a bruise is sort of longer because they might have fallen or maybe they're on some medication that makes it easy for them to bruise. Maybe they just bumped themselves.
According to statistics from the North Carolina Department of Aging, there were 21,000 reported cases of elder abuse in 2013. In only 2 years, the numbers rose to more than 179,000 cases. Dr. Nanette Lavoie-Vaughn is a clinical assistant professor at East Carolina University College of Nursing. She's also a nurse practitioner for geriatric neuropsychiatry services.
We're also seeing an increase in the elder population here in North Carolina exponentially over the last several years, and that's going to continue to grow in the next 5 years. And certainly any time the elder population grows, then unfortunately the amount and type of abuse grows as well.
Healthcare providers in any clinical setting are required to report abuse or suspected abuse to Adult Protective Services, part of the State Department of Health and Human Services.
A phone call is made and a report is given. And then certainly a complete physical examination is done, and any abnormal signs such as bruising, fractures, things that would look like the person has had a recent weight loss or has been dehydrated, that would show signs of physical abuse would be documented.
The patient is interviewed, as well as a family member or caregiver that is responsible for the person. Dr. Platts-Mills wants to take screening for elder abuse a step further. He and a team of researchers from the University of California, San Diego, and Weill Cornell Medicine have developed a new screening tool that seeks to improve the identification of elder abuse. The series of questions asks the patient if they have been called names, forced to give money against their will, or been hurt or threatened in the past 6 months. Platts-Mills says the more thorough tool will help doctors assess the patient's cognition and safety and improve elder abuse diagnosis.
If the patient is not cognitively intact, then we're going to do some additional work, and we will still ask the safety questions, but we'll also ask the screening person to do a physical examination of the patient to look for some findings that might suggest abuse.
The tool is still in the developmental phase. It will be tested in emergency departments in North Carolina, Michigan, and Alabama. If it is successful, he says it will be implemented more broadly around the state, including emergency departments in eastern North Carolina. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
Even though our shortened on-air fall fundraiser is over, the need to fully fund Public Radio East for the next 6 months remains. We greatly thank our new and renewing members who made a call of support or a pledge online. We know without member dollars, PRE would simply not exist. If you listen and have not made a pledge of support, please do your part. You can pledge online right now at publicradioeast.org. Just click on the red donate button. You can call in your donation now at 1-800-222-9832 or put your check in the mail addressed to Public Radio East, 800 College Court, New Bern, North Carolina, 28562. And thank you.
The History Museum of Carteret County will be hosting the American Music Festival concert series in Beaufort and Moorhead City. Mac McKee speaks to Barbara McKenzie, Artistic Director of the American Music Festival of North Carolina, about this Saturday's performance.
The Contras Quartet is the second concert of the year, and the Contras has a very interesting meaning of the name. It means contrast. Tell me how that definition came about and fits the Contras Quartet.
Well, the Contras came together bringing musicians from four different parts of the world, including South Africa, America, Russia, and Japan. And so Contras is a South African word for contrast. And so not only did they have a contrast in terms of, you know, their backgrounds and where they came from, but also just in the kinds of music that they're drawn to, which is why we were attracted to the Contras. In the first place, they give a, you know, just a really interesting program with a lot of diversity in terms of their programming.
Because they are from different places around the world. They play Villa-Lobos. They also play Dvorak. Lots of other different music. Do you think that their various backgrounds give them, I'll say, no fear in exploring what types of music there are out there?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'll make an analogy. If you just grow up eating cheddar cheese, you maybe just want cheddar cheese. But if you grow up and you're offered cheddar and brie and blue cheese and camembert, and, you know, then your palate's bigger and you want that kind of flavoring. And I think that's what happens with the Contras. You know, they bring us not only the tried and, you know, the true blue classics of Dvorak and Brahms, but they throw in some Argentinian and some Brazilian and, of course, American. And the program they're bringing this weekend on Saturday evening to the History Place is just a look at classical composers and how they showcase folk elements from the Slavic and Argentinian and Brazilian and American, African-American traditions.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the rest of the season for the American Music Festival?
Oh, sure. After the Contras, the next concert is January 28th with Amit Paled, and the title of that concert is Hommage à Pablo Casals. Israeli cellist Amit Palad is one of, he's been praised worldwide as one of the most exciting performers on the stage. And then on February 18th, we have the Harshavsky Piano Trio from New York. And in April, on the 22nd of April, we have the Jasper Quartet. These are the kinds of performances one would expect in Philadelphia or Washington or New York. And I hope people will come, maybe they're first-time listeners, but I hope they'll come and check us out because they will not be disappointed. They'll be really surprised if that's right here in Eastern North Carolina.
A venue in Morehead City is now called the History Museum of Carteret County, formerly known as the History Place, and the Contras Quartet will be playing this Saturday at 8 p.m., correct?
That is correct, and tickets are available at the door, or they can go to our website, AmericanMusicFestival.org.
Barbara, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
Thank you, Mac.
If you need more information regarding the American Music Festival schedule, you can check out our events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. The cool, crisp air makes garden and landscape maintenance much more pleasant in the fall, and there are several important tasks for us to do at this time of the year. These tasks will help our landscapes to get off to a healthier start next season. Fall is the time to give your landscape a good cleanup. In fact, cleaning up well at this time of year will help prevent disease and insect problems next year, since many pests spend the winter sheltering in old leaves and debris left from the previous season. If there are plants in your landscape that have had disease or insect problems this year, carefully clean up their fallen leaves and debris and remove it from your yard. Leaves that fall from healthy plants can be used as mulch or collected and composted. As perennials go dormant and leave behind only dry, dead stems, you can cut them back to ground level. You may want to leave some of them standing to provide a food source for the birds, particularly perennials with lots of seeds, like purple coneflowers and black-eyed Susans. Most ornamental grasses stand up well through the winter, adding texture and interest to the winter landscape. It's fine to cut back ornamental grasses if they start to look messy. For trees and shrubs, keep yourself to just minimal pruning to remove dead, broken, or diseased limbs and twigs, but save any large-scale pruning for late winter or early spring. Once all of the leaves have fallen, mow your lawn one last time. You can mulch fallen leaves with your lawnmower and spread a light layer over the yard to add organic matter to the soil. If mulched leaves are so thick that they obscure the grass, rake some of them away to avoid smothering your turf. You can give your landscape plantings a finishing touch by spreading a layer of mulch over top. But first, check to see how deep your mulch already is. 3 to 4 inches of mulch is perfect around most plants, but deeper levels can cause problems. Fall is the best time of year to plant and transplant most trees, shrubs, and perennials. In coastal areas, we can plant winter annuals like pansies, violas, ornamental cabbages, and snapdragons through November. We can plant spring-blooming bulbs in November and December. Daffodils, Spanish bluebells, summer snowflake, and blue star are all long-lived and deer-resistant varieties. Fall is also a great time for dividing and replanting perennials. Remember to keep your new plantings well watered during their first several weeks as they get established. Finally, you'll want to bring in any pots that can't take a freeze, terracotta, ceramic, and some decorative plastic pots. Store them in a dry, protected location to prevent freezing water from breaking or cracking the pots during the winter months. Once you tick these tasks off your to-do list, you can sit back and relax, knowing that your garden beds are ready for winter.
I live in Swansboro, North Carolina, and I've been listening for 4 years. I like the morning program, All Things Considered, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Public radio, I think, is a national treasure. My radio preset set to it. To me, it's brain candy. Every morning I listen to it, feel a little bit smarter going through the day. I think it's important. Became a new member. Now was the right time. I spent a career moving around with the military, listening to NPR on radio stations around the country. And now that I've settled in my permanent area, I couldn't wait to join. There's no better time than now. I couldn't think of a reason why I would wait until the next drive. When I heard it, I just said, now's the time to do it. I understand the listener support is a big revenue stream for the station, and I wanted to do my part. I am David Kramer, and I am Public Radio East.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.